It is Thursday, February 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump's nominee to the Supreme Court calls the president's criticism of the judiciary demoralizing. The British Parliament gives final approval for Brexit, and a new HBO series explores the lives of three complex women. We'll have a preview. It's all ahead. U.S. President Donald Trump's nominee to the Supreme Court, Judge Neil Gorsuch, has called the president's sharp criticism of the judiciary demoralizing and disheartening. Gorsuch commented while meeting privately Wednesday with Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal. Gorsuch's remarks were conveyed publicly by Senator Blumenthal. The essence of Gorsuch's remarks were confirmed by the Supreme Court nominee's office. President Trump reacted to Gorsuch's remarks Thursday on Twitter by apparently questioning the integrity of Senator Blumenthal. I spoke with Brandon Bartels, associate professor of political science at George Washington University. I asked him whether Gorsuch's comments about Trump's criticism of the judiciary were embarrassing to the Supreme Court nominee.
I would say it's somewhat embarrassing, but given Judge Gorsuch's background as a federal judge, I think, you know, any attacks on the judiciary in general from the elected branches are sort of taken as not friendly fire, so to speak. So I think any judge, regardless of whether they're this president's nominee, is going to react in a similar way to those types of comments.
Well, now, President Trump didn't wait too long. I mean, today on Twitter, he was very critical of Senator Blumenthal, saying Senator Richard Blumenthal on Twitter, I should say, Senator Richard Blumenthal, who never fought in Vietnam when he said for years he had, parentheses, major lie, now represents what Judge Gorsuch told him. You know, the president immediately made his opinion and his feeling about this known.
Yes. And that's not a surprise given President Trump's reaction to these types of stories. I mean, it is probably somewhat unprecedented for a senator to release what was, you know, the content of what was said in a meeting like this with a prospective Supreme Court nominee and a senator. So on that dimension, you can understand why both the president and perhaps Judge Gorsuch might be taken aback that this information was leaked. But on the other hand, I can understand why Judge Gorsuch would say that, and I can understand why President Trump would be seeking to criticize Senator Blumenthal for releasing that information.
Well, in a way, this almost continues a sort of style of, I guess you could say, media campaign that Mr. Trump used both in his presidential campaign and now, because he makes a statement on Twitter, it gets out there. And sometimes it can be, you know, pretty harsh, if not insulting, of the person he's criticizing.
Yes, definitely. And that, you know, I mean, President Trump has made no bones about turning up the heat on both senators, judges, the judiciary, and other officials with whom he, you know, it would behoove him to, you know, develop more friendly relations in order to form consensus and make policy and move his agenda forward, especially in this honeymoon period, which is so important for a new president.
But I suppose in a way, to his supporters, that's one of the things they like about him is his very direct, blunt style.
Right, exactly. And I think President Trump is expressing that the unconventional style and not the politics as usual that he campaigned on, the fact that he would not engage in politics as usual, at least relative to past presidents and past, you know, interactions between presidents and Congress. And, yeah, he's definitely demonstrating that in general.
Brendan Bartels, Associate Professor of Political Science at George Washington University. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's trending?
Well, it's no surprise that this story that you were just talking about is trending strongly on social media, on Facebook, on Twitter, and other places as well. One thing I just want to make clear, because it wasn't quite clarified. The president was obviously trying to cast aspersions on Senator Blumenthal's comments, basically saying Senator Blumenthal was lying. A White House official who is basically shepherding Judge Gorsuch around on Capitol Hill for these meet and greets has confirmed that that is what Neil Gorsuch said to Senator Blumenthal. So let's not get confused in all of the Twitter back and forth and everything. That is exactly the comments that the judge made, that President Trump's recent activities, comments were, quote, demoralizing and disheartening. So it's no surprise that lots of people are on Twitter. And again, I really honestly do make I'm making a strong effort to find people who are, say, sticking up for the president or saying, oh, you know, Senator Blumenthal, how terrible, et cetera, et cetera. And yet these are the things that I'm finding. Here's an item from ProPublica. ProPublica is an independent, not-for-profit news organization. One wrinkle to the president's point here, it's not true. Gorsuch, own spokesman hired by the White House, confirmed his comments. Donald Trump tweeted to an anchor, Chris Cuomo of CNN. President Trump tweeted, Chris Cuomo, in his interview with Senator Blumenthal, never asked him about his long-term lie about his brave, quote, service in Vietnam, fake news, exclamation point. Here's Christopher Cuomo tweeting back, sadly, POTUS is just wrong about the facts. It was my first point to the senator about his having misrepresented military career. Sigh. And here's a note from Emily Singer. Let's also, of all people to talk about Vietnam, it shouldn't be the guy who got five deferments for, quote, bone spurs. So lots of people talking about this. It's no surprise, really. People, you know, it was a divisive election. It's been a flurry of activity. And all of those opinions and counter opinions are really just bubbling over on social media. At some point, it might behoove some people to just kind of put the mobile phone down, push the computer away. You know, you don't necessarily have to be posting everything, but that's the kind of state what we're looking at today.
And I think it will continue.
That, and very quickly, also trending right now, and this is basically breaking news. The BBC, and I cannot believe this, is reporting that the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin, will not sing anymore. She is retiring. Oh. I know. I'm shocked. She said she may record one more album with Stevie Wonder, but that's it. She's not performing anymore. And people online are heartbroken. I can understand why.
Okay. Well, thank you for that, Doug, I guess. All right. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories trending. Turkey says a Russian airstrike has accidentally killed three Turkish soldiers. U.S. President Donald Trump targets Senator John McCain over the senator's criticism of the recent raid in Yemen. Senator Jeff Sessions has been sworn in as U.S. Attorney General, and a top U.S. general says the Afghanistan war is still a stalemate. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers have discovered what is thought to be the first white dwarf pulsar to be found in the universe. This astronomical oddity is located in a binary or two-star system identified as AR Scorpii, some 380 light-years from Earth. White dwarfs are the remaining cores of medium-mass stars that have used up their nuclear fuel. Pulsars, known as the lighthouses of the universe because they emit powerful and bright pulsating beams of radiation, are usually associated with rotating neutron stars, remainders of massive stars that exploded in supernovas. The white dwarf pulsar was found to be blasting its companion star, a red dwarf, with focused, powerful beams of electrical particles and radiation. And that is what, the astronomers say, causes the AR Scorpii system to brighten and dim twice every 2 minutes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we talk with a former congressman about President Trump's efforts to scale back regulations on financial services. Late Wednesday, the lower house of the British Parliament gave final approval to legislation triggering Britain's exit from the European Union.
The ayes to the right, 494. The noes to the left, 122. The ayes have it. The ayes have it.
That vote enables Conservative Prime Minister Theresa May to trigger Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, which begins a two-year process of exiting the 28-member EU. The debate now shifts to the House of Lords. Still, Australian National University analyst Anne-Marie Elijah tells International Edition's Victor Beattie she expected the measure to be approved there as well, keeping Ms. May's timetable of beginning Brexit March 31st intact.
I believe the timetable is still intact. Most analysts agree that in relation to the House of Lords, it is unlikely that the bill will be seriously held up there. There may be attempts to add some amendments, but generally the feeling is that if the House of Lords was to hold this bill up seriously, the role of the House of Lords itself may be called into question. So the feeling is, even though the Conservatives do not have a majority in the House of Lords, that in fact it will pass relatively smoothly.
Brexit Minister David Davis said we've seen a historic vote Wednesday night, a big majority for getting on with negotiating our exit from the EU and a strong new partnership with its member states.
Yes, and this is very much the British line now on how the UK will hope to relate to the European Union in a post-Brexit scenario. So that the UK will hope to maintain strong relations with the remaining 27 members of the European Union, but not be part of that process.
Anne-Marie, there was some indication that this debate would be bogged down by a host of amendments, but no amendments were attached. Why?
So in part, this is about the machinations, if you like, of the parliamentary process, which saw the Conservative majority able to get that bill through without having to incorporate those amendments that, of course, some Labor members, the SNP and other objectors had put forward. Analysts have been saying for a little while now that they thought there would be no difficulty with that in the Commons. The issues now are, one, what's going on in the Labor Party, which as time goes on, it becomes even more divided on the subject of the European Union, and of course, what's going on in relation to Scotland, because Nicola Sturgeon has again flagged that even though they cannot formally hold up the process of Brexit, that this may add to the momentum around a second referendum on Scottish independence.
Anne-Marie Elijah of the Australian National University. Well, among the many executive orders President Trump has signed since taking office is one that directs the Treasury Secretary to review the 2010 Dodd-Frank financial overhaul. The law is named after the co-sponsors of the law, Barney Frank and Chris Dodd. International Edition's Lori London spoke with former Democratic Congressman Barney Frank, who served as chair of the House Financial Services Committee and co-sponsored the legislation. She asked him what the president's order does.
Well, the executive order itself does literally nothing. It's almost like an essay, how I spent my summer recapitulated. It is a direction to the people who he will be appointing or has appointed, tell him what he thinks they should do to change the law. We legislated fairly specifically and explicitly, so there is nothing he can do by executive order to change that law, because it is a law and has to go through Congress. I am afraid that what he will do is to appoint people who will not use the powers that the law gives very vigorously, and that will be a problem, and it could lead to a buildup of behavior that could ultimately be damaging. But he will now be, I guess, within a couple of months from what he says, be asking Congress to change the law, and what he's up to is pretty much the opposite of what he said he was going to do in his campaign. He boasted about how he was going to go after Goldman Sachs. He attacked them in an ad by name. He was going to stand up to Wall Street. And instead, what he's doing is arguing for the diminution of all those rules that we put in place to prevent irresponsible behavior of the sort that caused the crisis. I don't think he will be successful. I think these actions are sufficiently popular with the public so that he's not going to get 60 Senate votes. In some cases, I don't think he'll get 50.
If the law were overturned or dismantled, what could potentially happen?
Two things. First of all, individual consumers will be hurt. We have protected consumers in a way they weren't before from abusive practices. The great majority of people in the industry are reasonable people, but there will always be some who will abuse. And the problem is, if you do not have good rules, in a situation in which economic entities are competing with each other, there is a tendency for those who are irresponsible to set the pace for the more responsible people. When you pass good laws that prevent abusive behavior, you're protecting the responsible people. What will happen is this. If we didn't have this law, it's what happened before. A number of financial institutions will behave irresponsibly, by which I mean they will take on more risk than they can handle. Now, in the short term, the more business you do as a financial institution, the more you lend to people, the more you trade, the higher your profits will be in the immediate sense. The problem is that you do not, in that situation, that's what happened before, make adequate preparation for things that will go wrong. You don't set aside enough reserves. You take risks. You lend money that you shouldn't lend because too good a likelihood will be paid back. And what happens is, over time, you get a buildup of more debt on the part of these institutions than they are able to discharge if things go wrong. Now, for a while, things may look very good. Everybody's happy because more and more is going on. But inevitably, in the economic cycle, some of this is going to go back the other way. And what happened before, and what we fear would happen again, is they will be so overextended in the debt they have incurred, in the extension of liabilities that they have incurred, that they won't be able to deal with this shortfall, and a crisis will occur.
So in other words, people that really can't afford home loans, for example, would be able to get them, and then ultimately the banks would be stuck again and we'd
exactly
have all
right.
the foreclosures.
One provision of the law is a specific prohibition on lending to people who basically can't pay it back. And by the way, that's the only provision in the law that restricts lending explicitly. That's exactly what will happen. You will have more of these loans to people who can't pay them back.
That's former Democratic Congressman Barney Frank, who also served as chair of the House Financial Services Committee. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition, a new limited series, Big Little Lies, starring Oscar winners Nicole Kidman and Reese Witherspoon, begins later this month on HBO. VOA's David Byrd has this look at the series.
Jane Chapman is a single mom whose son Ziggy is the result of a drunken one-night stand with a man named Saxon Banks. Jane, played by Shailene Woodley, is on her way to enroll her son in kindergarten in Monterey, California, when she meets two other women, Madeline McKenzie, played by Reese Witherspoon, and Celeste Wright, played by Nicole Kidman.
This is Jane Chapman. She's new here.
Hi.
Welcome, Renata Klein.
Thank you.
This is Amabella.
Hi. Beautiful dress.
How was your summer?
It was wonderful. Very busy with the kids and camp. Just flew by.
Same.
How was yours, yeah?
Well, joined the board of PayPal. What was I thinking? Adding one more thing to my life. But, you know, oh, hold on. These are my Hamilton tickets.
Okay.
I see four times.
I
yes.
I'll see you in there.
Madeline is resentful that her daughter from a previous marriage is growing closer to her ex-husband's new wife, Bonnie. Celeste is routinely abused by her banker husband, Perry, played in the HBO series by Alexander Skarsgård. Their complex relationships make up the crux of the story. The movie is based on the book of the same name by author Leanne Moriarty. She said at the premiere at the Chinese Theater in Hollywood that executive producers Kidman and Witherspoon had kept the screenplay faithful to her work.
Yeah, well, they've definitely stuck fairly closely to the story, and I've enjoyed seeing, so I can see some sentences of dialogue that I actually recognise, and some parts where I think, I hope I wrote that and not David E. Kelly, I want to get the credit for it. And so some parts they've taken different little steps with the storyline, but no, mostly it's quite true to the book.
The series is directed by Canadian Jean-Marc Vallée, who directed Witherspoon in the Oscar-nominated Wild and helped Matthew McConaughey win the Oscar for Dallas Buyers Club. At the premiere, Nicole Kidman said that Vallée has brought a cinematic sense to the limited series.
It unravels, you know, the story unravels. But you go with it, hopefully. I hope that people watch all 7 hours because it's meant to be watched as 7 hours because it's the way Jean-Marc works. He obviously makes films, first and foremost, so he's brought that cinematic sense to this piece. But you can't just watch 1 or 2 hours. You have to see it all because there's method to the madness, put it that way.
Reese Witherspoon said at the premiere that she hopes that women in the audience can see some of themselves in this series.
It's powerful, you know, when you actually connect with women and reflect back to them, their lives, and they see themselves on film. I think they have a bigger connection to the material. So I'm excited for women to see this and hopefully identify which character they're most like or see themselves in this show.
Big Little Lies also stars Laura Dern, who plays the overbearing mother Renata Klein. She says she sees the film as a reminder of women's power and influence.
Even more meaningful to be reminded that there are power in numbers and power in female numbers, and to celebrate each other and to use our voices to come together to tell stories, to get stories out there. You know, this is a beautiful time to be doing that.
The 7-hour-long series starts on HBO February 19th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And that's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for listening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has once again condemned Russia's action in Ukraine, following an escalation in fighting between government forces and Russia-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine. Speaking publicly for the first time before the United Nations Security Council, U.S. Permanent Representative to the UN, Ambassador Nikki Haley, deplored the fact that the United States must repeatedly condemn the aggressive actions of Russia.
It is unfortunate because it is a replay of far too many instances over many years in which United States representatives have needed to do that. It should not have to be that way. We do want to better our relations with Russia. However, the dire situation in eastern Ukraine is one that demands clear and strong condemnation of Russian actions.
Eastern Ukraine is not the only part of the country suffering from Russia's aggressive actions. Ambassador Haley pointed to Russia's occupation of Crimea and called for its immediate end.
Crimea is a part of Ukraine. Our Crimea-related sanctions will remain in place until Russia returns control over the peninsula to Ukraine. The basic principle of this United Nations is that states should live side by side in peace.
Full and immediate implementation of the Minsk agreements, which the United States continues to support, she said, is a clear path to restoring peace in Ukraine.
The Minsk agreements require the disengagement of forces and withdrawal of heavy weapons from both sides of the contact line. This is the formula for a sustainable ceasefire. Pulling back forces and taking heavy weapons out of this area will save lives. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe Special Monitoring Mission must also be granted full, unfettered access.
Ambassador Haley noted that both Russia and Ukraine supported the Security Council's unanimous call on January 31st to return to a ceasefire. It is the first time in years that this council was able to come together on Ukraine, she said. The United States expects that those who can influence the groups that are fighting, in particular Russia, will do everything possible to support an end to this escalation of violence. The United States stands with the people of Ukraine who have suffered for nearly 3 years under Russian occupation and military intervention, said Ambassador Haley. Until Russia and the separatists it supports respect Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity, this crisis will continue.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.